1 Kings chapter 17 and verse 8. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel, that I may drink. And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. And she said, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of meal in a jar, and a little oil in a cruse. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. And Elijah said to her, fear not, go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it, and bring it to me, and afterward make for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of meal shall not be spent, and the cruse of oil shall not fail, until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of meal was not spent, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke by Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, what have you against me, O man of God? You have come to bring my sin to remembrance, and to cause the death of my son. And he said to her, give me your son. And he took him from her bosom and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged, and laid him upon his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, O Lord my God, hast thou brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son? Then he stretched himself upon the child 3 times, and cried to the Lord, O Lord my God, let this child's soul come into him again. And the Lord hearkened to the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house, and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, your son lives. And the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. May God be praised for his holy word. Last week, we commenced the first of 4 studies, let me emphasize 4, 2 here, and then a gap of a week, and then 2 at Ringwood. And it's been jolly good to see others from, probably from Ringwood, I don't know who's from where, but joining us here, and so I hope those from Heathmont will join those from Ringwood for the completion of the series, a gap of a week, and then the next 2 weeks. But last week we commenced the first of 4 studies in the life and character and experience of the prophet Elijah. Now, as always, the most significant thing about any man is his relationship with God. The all-important thing about Elijah was his knowledge of and his relationship to God. As we were remarking last week, the very name of the man, Elijah, is Jehovah is God. This he believed, and this he lived by. When we are introduced to him, and he breaks on the page of history in a dramatic and unexpected fashion, but when we are introduced to him in the first verse of this chapter, we find him standing before that wicked tyrant Ahab, and telling Ahab that the Lord is the God of Israel. In other words, he says to Ahab, I don't mind what you think or what you say, God, the Lord, Jehovah, has not abdicated. He has not renounced his position as the sovereign Lord. And he lives. before whom I stand. For Elijah, God was the living God. I quoted last week a very short extract from a book that bears the title The Living God, an excellent little paperback, a handbook on the nature of God by R.T. France. And he says this, "The living God, a God to be reckoned with, active, dynamic, relentlessly and uncomfortably present." Now, for those of you who like to think of God as being very comfortably present, perhaps it's a good idea to be reminded that when God is present, he is often uncomfortably present. We've got that kind of God. A God who is active, dynamic, relentless, a God to be reckoned with. And this was the kind of God in whom Elijah believed. He professes to believe in a God who is actively in control of his world, not some absent landlord. Not the kind of God of the people who believe in a mechanistic universe, the kind of God who created it at the beginning and now allows it just to go on year after year by cause and effect, bound, as it were, by the laws of nature, as though God in his creation had made a clock, wound it up at the beginning of the creation, and now allows it just to go tick-tock, tick-tock, cause and effect, and occasionally tinkering with it with tweezers, and we call that a miracle. But otherwise, it just goes, cause and effect, tick-tock, through all the earth. That's not the picture. The God we have is a God who is instinct in his creation. The one who causes his sun to rise on the just and on the unjust, on the good and the bad, and his rain to descend. God is as active in his creation, causing the sun to rise and the sun to set, as he is when he works the great miracles of which we read in Holy Scripture. It is not a greater output of divine power, it's just a different one. That's all. And because different, arrested. That's the purpose of it. But God is immediate in his relationship to his world. And Elijah knew that. And so he prayed that it might not rain. And it didn't rain. For 3 years and 6 months in all. Here is a man who believes in the living God, who is the sovereign creator over his world, the God who withholds and the God who sends the rain. But not only so, he believes in the living God who is powerfully ordering the affairs of men and nations, the one who will act in mercy and in judgment towards men, the one who has authority. For Elijah knew that ultimate authority did not rest with an Ahab, nor even with his scheming, unscrupulous wife Jezebel. Ultimate authority, even in national affairs, Elijah knew belonged to God. The living God, and again one who was immediately concerned for his servant. For Elijah knew himself to be the personal care of the living God. May I pause to ask if you believe that? That you are in the personal care of the living God. We haven't got a God who nods off to sleep, as the gods of the pagans were supposed to do, or going on a journey. We'll be thinking about that in a fortnight's time, as Elijah mocked the prophets of Baal. Now, that's not our God. The God who is immediately concerned for his children, and we are in his personal care. Now, because God is the living God, then he possesses the right to the administration of life. And that's my first point. The administration of life. Elijah is God's servant. He says, "Before whom I stand." And as we were remarking last week, the very posture indicates that of the servant who is anxious to do his Lord's bidding. "Before whom I stand," his role is of the slave, to give an unquestioning obedience to his master, a willing compliance, a glad loyalty to him who is Lord. This was the main lesson of verses 1 to 7. Obedience, submission, patience. Irksome it will have been, doubtless, to Elijah to be told to go and hide yourself. I mean, a big, strong man like Elijah, mountain of a man, I would imagine Elijah was. Great big man, strong man, man of the deserts. Elijah,
Go and hide yourself.
It's offensive, in all probability, it was for him to be willing to receive food from the beaks of the unclean ravens. Bad enough to have a clean bird bringing your breakfast to you and your evening meal. But an unclean bird like the raven, I can imagine that Elijah was pretty shocked when God told him that they were the divine helicopters that were going to come in with the provision for him morning and evening. But tedious it must have been for him. That man, so active, virile type of man, sitting down there day after day watching a brook. And this brook becoming a trickle. And this trickle eventually drying up. But God is the living God. The God who is in control. The God who has the right to administer the lives of his servants. And he is training his servant, and training him particularly in the lessons of faith and patience. Elijah, you must trust me in every circumstance. And if I do not explain things to you, you mustn't necessarily ask. You must be prepared to be like Job and stick it out, and say in your heart, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Elijah, you must be prepared to await God's time. Sit here and wait. And he waits, and he sees, as I describe it, that stream becoming just a trickle, and then not even a trickle. It came to pass after a while that the brook dried up. This underlines the doctrine that you will find throughout Holy Scripture, which we might call, viewed from a human standpoint, the doctrine of divine delay. It is epitomized in one of the parables of Jesus in Luke chapter 18. He would not for a while. Divine delay. It is part of God's discipline. Remember, Abram was given the promise that he and his wife would have a baby. A baby boy. And they waited. The 9 months went by and no babe was born. And the year stretched into 2 years, and the 2 years into 5 years, and the 5 years into 10 years, and more than that. And the child was not born. And he was learning that you have to inherit some of the promises of God with faith and patience. Faith and patience. So many people imagine that all the promises of God are to be inherited immediately by faith. God says, faith and patience, some of them you will not see fulfilled until a coming day, at the very end of the day indeed. The redemption of the body is not yet at one. And it is through faith and patience that we inherit the promises. And it's written largely in the New Testament, this doctrine of divine delay. They have no wine, says Mary to Jesus. Woman, what is that to thee? Mine hour is not yet come. It must be known by all that the wine has completely run out before Jesus will intervene. Mary and Martha send a message to Jesus. Lord, he whom you love is sick. And he stayed 2 days still in the same place where he was. And when at length he came, they greeted him with the information that Lazarus was not only dead and buried, but he'd been in the grave 4 days already. Divine delay. The two on the Emmaus Road say to the stranger who joins them, and today is the third day since these things were done. One of our dangers is that we want everything immediately. We want it now. One of the major banks, one of the main 5 banks in Britain, coined the advertising slogan when they started off their bank cards, take the waiting out of wanting. And I was very, very glad that a number of the national newspapers took up the cudgels against that bank and said that this was an immoral thing. Take the waiting out of wanting, it said. And so many Christians want that. They don't want to wait. They want it now, in so many ways. And God says no, through faith and patience. The living God possesses the right to the administration of life. After a while, the brook dried up. No wonder then, we read in verse 8, then the word of the Lord came to him. God delays the communication of his will until the need for direction is essential. God is under no obligation to disclose his purposes in advance. Now, the majority of us would just love that. Lord, what's going to happen after this? What am I to do then? And we look to the future. We want to make our plans in advance. And it is from time to time that God does disclose his purposes in advance to his children, but not always. In fact, most frequently he does not. We must be prepared to wait his time. And as I said last week, God's 11th hour is sometimes about 11:45. And this is one of the disciplines to which we are being subjected. Faith and patience. But at the right time, the instructions come. Meanwhile, it is ours to wait patiently and confidently. And we may be well assured that God has laid his plans in advance. God is not like the British government, and I'll say nothing about the Australian one, about which I know nothing anyway, but God is not like the British government that moves from crisis to crisis. You know, as though, get this crisis over and then I'll make up contingency plans for the next one. No, there are no emergencies with God. Known unto God are all his ways from the beginning. No element of surprise as far as he is concerned. And long in advance, the situation had been known to God and the preparation had been made. And we read of it here in verse 9. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow woman there to feed you. Incidentally, we need not infer from this that this widow woman had already been tipped off by God as to what her responsibilities were going to be. After all, the same word does occur back in verse 4. You shall drink from the brook I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. God had not disclosed his plans to the ravens. It merely meant that God had put the whole scheme into operation. He had given instructions. He'd set in motion these things for the welfare of his servant. And as God had done so through creation with the ravens, so he was going to do so now through this widow woman living at Zarephath. God was the living God. And he had personally put in hand these means for the care of his servant. But he who serves the living God must be prepared for this God to act sovereignly in ways which might well appear to us to be unorthodox. Verse 8 contains the divine instruction to Elijah. Arise, go to Zarephath. And I can imagine Elijah saying, say that again. Did I hear that aright? Zarephath, did you say? Yes. Go to Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow. Did I hear that aright? How strange. How shocking indeed it must have seemed to Elijah. The place to which he had to go. And then secondly, the person who was to sustain him. Let's think about these two things. The place, Zarephath, 80 to 100 miles away from where he was at the moment, and a very difficult journey, particularly due to the long drought and the famine in the land. But not only difficult, it was dangerous. Ahab had his spies out looking for Elijah. The whole country would be riddled with them. To find his way from Cherith to Zarephath would have been an exceedingly difficult and dangerous undertaking. But that's the divine command. But it wasn't so much that that worried Elijah. After all, he was a pretty courageous sort of type. And he wouldn't get greatly alarmed about that. He was a man of the country, man of the great outdoors. No, it was this, that Zarephath lay in the heart of a Canaanite territory, which was the home of Baal worship. Zarephath. Jezebel herself had come from that area. Moreover, the meaning of Zarephath, according to Mr. Young of the Young's Concordance, of whom I spoke glowingly last week, according to him, the very word means the place of refining. And that must have sounded pretty ominous in the years of Elijah. But God is the living God. And when we say this, we must be prepared to allow him to be the living God. The God who is in control. And if God had chosen to supply Elijah's diet via the ravens, the unclean birds, What right had his servant now to complain if God had elected to send him to Zarephath, a heathen city? But even more surprising to the prophet must have been his intimation about his support. The person who would sustain him, a widow. Strange place and a strange person. I repeat, Elijah was strong. He was a man's man, virile, active. And he was being asked by God to go and be dependent on a woman. And a widow woman at that. How utterly humiliating. And not only was she a woman, and a widow woman, she was poor. And how poor, as the record makes plain. Now Jesus himself, during his lifetime, was willing to receive financial support from women. But these were doubtless wealthy women. Luke tells us of them. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and Susanna and many others who provided for him out of their means. But Elijah was to be dependent upon a woman who was a widow and who was poor. It was calculated to sound the death knell of pride as far as Elijah was concerned. But worse, not only a woman and a widow and poor, but a Gentile. God is sovereign. It's the living God. He is the one who has the right to the administration of our lives. And I say again, we may not lay down laws about God as to what he can and cannot do, or about what he ought or ought not to do. This has been the tragic of so much evangelical life, that we have constructed straitjackets for God. We've imagined that we built them up from the New Testament. Actually, a closer look at the New Testament would reveal that they are largely imaginary. But nevertheless, they have been constructed on the plea that these represent New Testament truth. And we say, God virtually must work within these or not at all. Can't confine the living God within such limits as those. God will himself only exercise, will only ever operate within moral laws. He is the God who cannot lie in such right. But when it comes to such things as those that I have mentioned, we cannot cabin and limit God within such strictures. There is a freedom in the ways of God, a glorious freedom, that is fresh and exciting and exhilarating. And God will manifest himself in ways so wholly unexpected as are calculated to thrill the soul of the one who is prepared to observe and enjoy and obey. And so, that freedom which belongs to God calls forth from you and from me an unquestioning obedience. But again, to gauge how offensive this action of God was to a Jew and a pious Jew, we only need to recall how incensed Jesus' fellow townsfolk at Nazareth were when he told them about this incident. He reminded them of it in these words. I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when there came a great famine over all the land, and Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Zidon, to a woman who was a widow. When they heard this, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up and put him out of the city, and led him to the brow of the hill on which the city was built, that they might throw him down headlong. They hated to be reminded that God did not merely work within limits that they thought that he ought to work within. And they were incensed and angry. But God is not limited to place or to person as we might imagine. And so for ourselves as Elijah, despite our surprise and perhaps our shock, we must ever be willing to move forward with God. Unless you might think I am building a rather big superstructure on an inadequate foundation, let me ask you to go home and read the great speech of Stephen, his great defense. And it's all really centering on this same truth. Where was Abram when God called him, he asks? In Ur of the Chaldees. Where was Moses? In the wilderness.
Where was Joseph? In a prison. Where does God manifest himself? In the temple? No, in the tabernacle. It's all really centering upon exactly the same list. God is sovereign. He has the right to determine where and how and by whom his servant shall be sustained. It will be at one time at Cherith, and another time at Zarephath. He has the right to determine through whom his servants will be sustained. By birds and a brook, or by a Gentile poor widow woman. He had to learn, as we have to learn, that God's servants' trust must not be in the agencies that God uses, but in the Lord himself. Not in the agencies that he chooses to use, but in the Lord himself. The all-important thing is that we be obedient. Note before we pass on to our next point, just one word, the word there. Verse 4, you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. Verse 9, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. Verse 10, behold, a woman was there gathering sticks, and he called to her, and so on. There, be in the place of my appointing, says God, and you can leave the rest to me. As long as you are where I want you to be, then I will assume full responsibility for your maintenance and for your being used in my service. The second great lesson of this section is that because God is the living God, then he is the source of the preservation of life. Not only its administration, but its preservation. Now, Elijah had already learned this in a sense for himself at Cherith. But he's going to learn at Zarephath that God is able not only to look after him, but to look after others through him. And so he arrives at the gate of the city. Read of it in verse 10. He arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks, and he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel, that I may drink. And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. I like to think that as Elijah was making his way towards Zarephath, he said to himself, now, how on earth am I going to identify this woman? After all, there have been lots of women in Zarephath, and I dare say there were lots of widows. In any case, he couldn't go up to a lady and say, excuse me, are you a widow? Are you the person that's going to look after me when I come here? You know, how is he going to identify her? And his mind starts ticking over, and he says to himself, well, there was another character in the Old Testament who had to identify a lady, and he didn't know how to do so. She was going to be the wife of his master's son. And this particular man, by name Eliezer, made a sort of compact with God. And he said to God, when I say to a lady, give me a drink, and she replies, yes, I'll give you a drink, and I'll give you a camel's drink also, that would be the one. So Elijah virtually says to himself, that's what Eliezer did. I might as well adopt the same tactic. So he goes up to this lady and he says to her, bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. And she goes to get him and thinks, jolly good. Now, as Eliezer had sort of two tests, will she get water for me or will she get water for my camels? He had a second question, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. And so he identifies the person who's going to care for him. On the other hand, such a request for a drink may have been the only acceptable way in the culture of that day of commencing a conversation between a man and a woman in public, particularly between a Jew and a Gentile. And there was another, greater than Eliezer and greater than Elijah, who did that. Give me a drink, he said to a woman. And he identified a person in deep need, whose need he could meet. Well, that's how the conversation started. And then the request from Elijah elicited from the woman a confession of her tragic plight. Her tragic plight. She says, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing big, only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in the cruse, and now I'm gathering a couple of sticks, that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. Two ingredients, two sticks, two mouths.
She says, this is all I've got, handful of meal and a little oil. I'm gathering a couple of sticks with which to light a fire, and there are two of us to eat what I produce, my son and myself. And after we've had this meager meal, then there is no prospect for us apart from death. We will eat it and die. Their tragic plight. And then the prophet makes this extraordinary plea. Verse 30. But first, make me a little cake. Now, if you read that without sort of the preconceived evangelical notions of the passage, you know, you read it as though you come to a threat. This is all I've got. Handful of meal and a bit of oil. I'm gathering a couple of sticks with which to light a fire, and there are two of us to eat what I produce, my son and myself. And after we've had this meager meal, then there is no prospect for us apart from death. We will eat it and die. That tragic plight. And then the prophet makes this extraordinary plea. Verse 30. But first, make me a little cake. Now, if you read that without sort of the preconceived evangelical notions of the passage, you know, you read it as though you come to it freshly, you say to yourself, my, how utterly unwarranted, how completely selfish. This man who says to this poor widow, who's got enough food for herself and her son, make me a little cake first. But we must read between the lines. But he may read between the lines by seeing her immediate response to him. She said, verse 12, as the Lord your God lives. How did she know that Jehovah was his God? Had she already guessed at his identity, that he was a man of God? Had he already told her? I don't know. I rather think that she had looked at him and said to herself, I know this is. This is that prophet that we've heard about, Elijah. This man who is responsible for the drought. I know who this is. He's the one who serves the living God. As the Lord your God lives, she says. And Elijah knows that she knows who he is and knows something about his God. So he places this challenge before her. And this extraordinary plea is the sort of test. Make me, as the representative of the living God, make me a little cake first. Put me first, and then see what will happen. This is what Jesus says to you and to me. Seek first my kingdom and righteousness. All these things shall be added unto you. Me first, says Jesus Christ. Everything about us says me first. This is native to us as a result of the fall. Selfishness. Me first. And Christ says to us, no, not you first, me first. And that's what the plea was to this woman. But it was accompanied by this confident pledge. If you'll do that, says Elijah to her, the jar of meal, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of meal shall not be spent, and the cruse of oil shall not fail until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. The promise of Jehovah, the God of Israel, is that their need shall miraculously be met as long as the emergency lasts. Incidentally, after that, it will be met in the normal way. As I said last week, God is pretty economical with miracles. He doesn't sort of just throw them away needlessly. After all, the manna will be given while they're in the wilderness, but as soon as the wilderness journey is over, then they'll plant and they'll reap their crops. That's how God will normally does it, but in an emergency, then he will meet it miraculously. Wherever we fulfill the conditions that God imposes, his promise is fulfilled. Seek first his kingdom and righteousness. All these things shall be yours as well. And the plea stands, and the pledge stand still. And we read in verse 15, and she went and did as Elijah said. There is something delightfully simple about this narrative. There is a beautiful economy of words, and we preachers need to learn from it. She went and did. Obedience, simple, direct, and immediate. That's what God is asking of you. That we respond to him immediately,
implicitly in obedience. Then God steps in as promised, and in response to the obedience of faith, this provision is secured, and that during many days, as the record says, right throughout the famine, God supplied their needs. Inadequate resources, but viewed from a human standpoint, it was enough to make just enough for one meal, and that was all. But given over to God, and it meets the need of many days. It is acceptable according to what a man has and not according to what he has not, says Paul. Give God what you've got, and it's amazing what he will do with it. The third lesson, and the even more dramatic lesson, that the God being the living God is the one who is able to grant restoration of life, or restoration to life, if you like. With verse 17, we're brought face to face with one of the great mysteries of life. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And Elijah must have said, and certainly the widow woman said, has the child been preserved only to perish? Is this the way that God rewards those who faithfully obey and serve him? Of course, the fact is that being faithful, we do not place God under any sort of obligation. That's the kind of thinking that underlies so much of this sort of remark. Isn't it strange, dear old Mrs. Fernseth? She served God all her life, such a quiet, lovely Christian, and now she is suffering such a severe illness, and obviously she's going to die shortly. Now, behind that is the idea that somehow living a gracious, obedient Christian life places God under some sort of obligation. That can never be the case. When we have done all, we've only done what was our duty to do, said Jesus in one of his parables. The words of God to Job, who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. And yet I have so often heard the remark, God is no man's debtor. Look that one up in Young's Concordance, and if you find it, come and tell me. This isn't even in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, but certainly would be in an evangelical counterpart to that. God is no man's debtor. In some ways, what a ridiculous thing to say. As though we could ever place God in our debt. If we had obeyed God from the first day until now in everything, God would not be under any obligation to us. Now, I understand what meant by it. Don't get me wrong. I appreciate the sentiment that underlies it. But in point of fact, it is a dangerous thing to say. Because God could never, ever be in anybody's debt. How could he? Everything belongs to him. Who was given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. As Jesus says in another of his parables, am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? You know, God could have said that to the widow woman about that boy. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? He'd given her the child, he'd sustained the child. If he took the child, it was perfectly legitimate. We have no grounds for expecting immunity from trial, or of claiming exemption from sorrow. Not at all. And yet, the mystery remains. In her grief, the widow accuses Elijah of being the instrument of judgment. Excuse me. Perhaps she imagined that this bereavement was some kind of penalty, because she says, you have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance. Incidentally, the word remember in Scripture means far more than recollection. You know, we use the word remember, you say to somebody, now excuse me, I remember your face, but do tell me your name. You know, remember, the ability to call back into our mind something that we've forgotten. That is not what it means when it says that God remembers, because from that standpoint, God never forgets. Except our sin, and this he does deliberately, because God has a reverse gear on his memory that we don't possess. He puts it into reverse about our sin. But when it says remember in the Bible about God, it's an active word. God remembered Noah. Doesn't mean that God was up in his high heaven and then he suddenly said, oh yes, Noah. God remembered Noah means that God did something about Noah. He actively intervened for Noah. When it says God remembered Sarah, wasn't it that suddenly Sarah's name came back to his mind again? But that God did something about Sarah. And so when it says, your sins and your iniquities will I remember no more, it means that God has already remembered them and he's done something about them in Jesus Christ. He has answered them, borne them away forever. And therefore he's able to say, I will remember them no more. I will no longer need to do anything about them because I've done all that needs to be done about them. This woman says, have you come to bring my sin to remembrance? Is it that that past sin of mine has now been brought out into the open and as a result something active is being done about it and I'm being punished? And she had that rather strange and awful notion that the disciples had when they came to Jesus and said, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? But I can understand the woman in a sense, because after all, Elijah had been the instrument in bringing judgment on the nation for its sin. And she says, I'm a sinner, and now you're the agent of God in bringing judgment upon me. And in the bitterness of her spirit, she charges him with the responsibility of the death of her son. And her words must have stung Elijah like the lash of a whip. What did he do? He ignored them. You see, in times of deep grief, people are likely to say things in the bitterness of their spirit that afterwards they will regret. Those words are best ignored. Jesus did it. When he arrived to Mary and Martha, they'd been reciting it all the time through the 4 days. If only he'd been here, this would never have happened. So Martha meets him and she says, Lord, if you'd only been here, my brother would not have died. And Mary, who didn't know that Martha had said it when she met Jesus, said exactly the same, which leads us to conclude that they've been saying it to one another throughout the 4 days. Lord, if only you'd be. What an awful thing to say to Jesus. What they are really saying is this, it's all your fault. If only you'd come when you were sent for, this would never have happened. It's all your fault. What does Jesus do? He ignores it. And we must take a leaf out of the book of Elijah and of Jesus as well. Ignore it. There are things said, I repeat at times, under deep emotional stress that are best disregarded. In any case, Elijah didn't have a ready-made answer to this strange event. The offering of facile explanations to profound problems is not only ill-advised, it can be cruel. And some people have ready-made answers to the deep inner spiritual, moral, and personal dilemmas that people face. And they trot out the answer. This, I repeat, is not only ill-advised, it can be a cruel thing to do. At the same time, the prophet doesn't opt out. He doesn't run away from the tragedy. He had been used by the living God for the preservation of life. He says to himself, perhaps in the mercy of God I may be used for the restoration of life. And he was. But it was costly. Involve two things, identification and intercession. Give me your son, he says to the woman. He bears the burden of the lifeless child. Heavy that lifeless body, he carries it up to his own room. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. That's what he does. In fact, he said, give me your sin. Not your son. Give me your sin. And he bore that away. And he who spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not also with him freely give us all things? Every other burden is encompassed in that. But Elijah, as Christ later, bears another's burden. Identification thus with a widow in her sorrow, but identification with a child in his lifelessness. And we read in verse 21 that he stretched himself upon the child 3 times. Elisha later was to do the same thing. His mouth to the mouth of the lifeless child, his eyes to the eyes of the lifeless, and his hands upon the hands of the lifeless. He stretches himself Paul does the same with Eutychus. He bent over him, embracing him. This isn't just the kiss of life. This is identification with another in the other's need. And if we would be effective in meeting the needs of people, there must be a willingness for costly identification. Now, I've been learning a bit about this since I've arrived in Melbourne, as I chatted to one and another. The identification of some people with young people. Young people that they don't naturally feel drawn to, perhaps. But in order to win them for Christ, they are prepared to identify with them. And if we would influence anyone for Christ, we must be prepared for a costly identification. He stretched himself upon the child. Let's remember the identification of Christ with us, and how infinitely costly that was. Let that be the motive. But not only identification, but intercession. The work of life-giving is God's alone, and so the prophet prays. Two prayers. Verse 20, the first prayer. O Lord my God, hast thou brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son? What's he doing? He's sharing his perplexity with God. He's honest with God. He doesn't sort of be awfully polite and nice. He just says exactly how he feels, and he shares his deep perplexity with the Lord. He seeks to enter into the ways and the purposes of God. Lord Jehovah, my God. He lays hold in confidence upon the God that he knows, but he confesses himself utterly baffled by what has transpired. God, he says, I know you're in control. Hath thou brought calamity? Lord, surely you're the doer of all things. What's happening? He pleads with God. You can tell it in the wording of the prayer. Calamity is the word that he uses. Lord, he says, this is a tragedy. The widow, the needy one, surely God is the God of the widow. So he mentions the fact that she's a widow. With whom I sojourn, Lord, she's deserving, she's worthy. And so he prays. And prayer number two is found in verse 21. O Lord my God, let this child's soul come into him again. But I can't help feeling that prayer number one has led to some fresh confidence and certainly to a clarification of the will of God. And this is one of the great byproducts of prayer, that it leads us into a clearer understanding of what God is about. But about the prayer, note with me its simplicity, note its brevity, note its directness, note its urgency, note its intensity. The little word, oh, prefaces both prayers. Oh! Oh! He cries, and his soul is in his praying. Twice it is said that he cried to the Lord. But the thing that strikes one as one reads it is this, that he says exactly what he wants and exactly what he needs. O Lord, my God, let this child's soul come into him again. Full stop. We've got a strange idea that we must be talking all the time and at great length if God is going to hear. It would be far more profitable if we waited in the presence of God silently until we made up our minds exactly what we wanted to say and said it. May I ask, especially you young people here tonight, do you ever write your prayers? You know, I write notes to God regularly because I find that writing clarifies thinking. And I say to myself, now, what exactly do you want to ask God? Then I write it down. Then I say, what next do you want to ask him? And write it down. There it is, absolutely precise. Perhaps you don't need to do that. Your mind may work more readily than mine, more clearly. Let's be precise in our request. Let's condense it into one sentence. And oh, that our public prayers were like this. You know, we could set our prayer meetings alight. If a company like this came together to pray, and I don't know how many are here, perhaps 80, 85, something like that, And the whole 85 could pray in an hour. Just think of this. As you think, what do I want to ask God? You don't ramble over ever so many things, but it's pointed and precise and urgent and direct and effective. Earlier he had professed that God was the living God, and he believes it still. He's acknowledged that by his obedience that God is the one who administers life. Over many days he has proved that God is the God who preserves life. Now he's convinced that God is the God who restores life. And what faith is this? Because it's got no precedence. You know, it's not so bad in believing that God can raise the dead if he's done it a number of times before. But as far as I know, God had never done it before. And so he was not working on any precedence. But he believes in the living God, and therefore the God who can give life. And so he prays. And so God works. And as we sang in our opening hymn, in the great words of Wesley, power into strength for souls he speaks, and life into the dead. And the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And the story ends with a most affecting scene. The child is restored to the mother. And the woman's rejoinder here in verse 24, now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. And that would have been a great encouragement to Elijah for the days ahead. For those days were going to find stiffer tests than ever presenting themselves to the prophet. Samaria and Ahab's court, Cherith and the ravens and the brook, Zarephath and the widow and her son, these in turn had proved the places of God's appointment for his servant. God had proved himself yet again to be the living God. May we know him so, for his name's sake. Amen. I wonder if you could take time to sing number 368. Father, I know that all my life is portioned out for me. The changes that will surely come, I do not fear to see. I ask thee for a present mind, intent on pleasing thee. I ask thee for a thoughtful love, through constant watching, wise, to meet the glad with joyful smiles and weep, and wipe the weeping eyes. A heart at leisure from itself to soothe and sympathize. Number 368. Interrupt and ask how many know that tune? I fear not. There are alternatives. If we could just, I'll read another verse. This is a sort of Sunday morning statement. I'll read another verse while another brother is finding another tune. But we have the organ to help us tonight. I would not have a restless will that hurries to and fro, seeking for some great thing to do or secret thing to know. I would be treated as a child and guided where I go. Wherever in the world I am, in whatsoever state, I have a fellowship with hearts to keep and cultivate, a work of lowly love to do, for him on whom I wait. Mm-hmm.